Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest today is Federico Rampini, who is the bureau chief of the Italian newspaper La Repubblica, the bureau chief here in the United States. Federico, welcome back to Berkeley.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Help us understand the constraints on the economy of Italy in this very trying time for Europe.
Well, I would say basically these constraints have two origins. One is the great financial crisis that started here in the U.S. in 2008, and then the contagion effect that disrupted European economies. And definitely Italy was a weak link among the European economies, not as strong as Germany. The other constraint comes from Italy belonging to the euro. And therefore, Italy is now subjected to an austerity, which is probably not the wisest economic policy, but it is the economic policy that Germany is imposing all over the eurozone. So we are in the middle of a recession. Italy is officially in its second recession in 5 years. And at the same time, we are under very severe fiscal tightening, both in terms of tax raises and welfare state cuts.
When you were on our program several years back, at that time we talked about the expectations of Italy for joining the euro. What have been the disappointments there? Was there a hope that that process would, that integration process would help reform Italian institutions and the Italian economy?
Yes, there were lots of hopes. I remember well. We met when I was when I moved from Europe here to California in the year 2000, and that was the year after the theoretical creation of the euro, whereas the circulation of euro in form of banknotes started in 2002. There were enormous expectations. Part of those expectations came to happen and were realized. But I would say that today, if you ask the average Italian citizen, disappointments are much larger. The euro did not deliver financial stability when the first major external shock happened, that is the U.S.-made crisis of 2008. We were completely destabilized by the panic on financial markets. Our interest rates on treasury bonds went sky high, and we were almost on the verge of a default. At least this was the perception of public opinion and the financial markets. And the euro did not deliver strong economic growth and full employment, which are the main things people care about.
Mm-hmm. And what is the failure here? Is it, in the first instance, a failure to design institutions to go all the way with the process, so there wasn't political unity and there wasn't fiscal unity that went with the monetary unity? Is that the core of this problem when we say that the EU did not help Italy respond to the 2008 crisis?
Yes, I agree, but let me start by saying that I think, first of all, Italy did not help itself enough. I think the first and major responsibility bears on Italian governments and Italian actors in the economy, Italian capitalism, Italian unions. I mean, what they did not understand was that or they did not fully understand, they did not grasp all the consequences, was that by becoming a member of the Eurozone and the currency union, we completely lost our monetary sovereignty. We were not able to devalue our currency. We were not able to fix our own interest rates. The devaluation is the real issue, because Italy had, for decades, had prospered with an economic model based on competition through devaluation. So since the moment when we became a member of the euro, we had to be to become as competitive as the Germans, which meant much more investment in R&D, innovation, technology, whereas we were more, in terms of our specialization, look at the textile apparel industry, we were more a competitor with the Chinese, not with the Germans. I think that that's the major problem. And then what you say is right. Europe is incomplete union. We have a single currency. We don't have a government. We don't have a real federal government with centralized power. We don't have fiscal union. We don't have a budgetary union. So it's true that the institution issue is there.
You come out of the left politically, and you know there were dreams on the part of the left in earlier eras that the working class, you know, throughout the world would unite, and there was a sense of the universality. But we see now that nothing has transformed the national cultures or institutions of most of the countries in Europe, which on the one hand could be a very positive thing. But on the other hand, in the course of solving some of Europe's problems, dominant actors and their culture, their political culture, their institutional history seem to dominate the discourse.
Yes, although you might also say that there is something like a European social model, that if you compare Europe to the United States, or even more, if you compare Europe to emerging countries like China or India, there are more similarities between labor practices, labor regulation, labor rights, union organization inside Europe. So it's there is something like a European labor movement. But it's true that inside that model, there still are national differences. And unions in Germany, for instance, come from a tradition of cooperation with management. They have a lot of power inside the companies. They are represented in the boards of companies, but at the same time, they don't go on strike very often. Whereas in Southern Europe, Italy, France, Spain, unions are much more combative and less cooperative. So we do have inside the European social model, you have a Nordic model, a German model, and then a Mediterranean model. It's true that cultures matter, and national cultures still matter, even in a global economy.
There was a hope when you were moving to the euro that this would be a way for Europe to meet the challenge of globalization and the dominance of globalization by the United States. Talk a little about that. To what extent has that worked?
Well, it was definitely one of the main reasons why we adopted the single currency. One has to remember that historically, I think that probably the French are the real fathers of the single currency, because they started with General Charles de Gaulle and his economic counselor, the economist Jacques Rueff. Already in the 60s, they started attacking and criticizing the hegemonic role of the dollar in the international monetary system. They saw that the hegemony of the dollar let the U.S. Finance the Vietnam War and then spread the cost all over the rest of the world through liquidity creation and inflation. So the idea basically at the origin, the idea of a European single currency was really to create at least a bipolar world where the dollar would not be the hegemon. Then it became also a trade-off between France and Germany when Germany reunified. The French wanted at least Germany to share its currency, the Deutschmark. That's where the project comes from. And then it didn't. This is another example of how the euro didn't really deliver. For instance, the euro today, more than 10 years after its the starting of its circulation, still is a tiny percentage of the official reserves of central bank. The Chinese central bank has started diversifying its reserve, but still most of it is in US dollars. So the challenge has not been fulfilled or not won.
What was the expectation about joining the euro on the part of the left in Europe and in Italy? Did they see particular programs, policies emerging in their ideal of what membership in the euro meant?
Well, at the beginning, the euro was not a project of the left or by the left. I should remember that that left to which I belonged in Italy, the Italian Communist Party, in the 50s and in the 60s was against all the European integration because they saw the European integration as a project under the leadership of the U.S., a capitalistic project and basically led or inspired by American interests. So the left, social democrats in Germany, socialists in France had different approaches, but the left was a latecomer to the European dream. But when they embraced it, they did it with a very strong conviction that only by creating a real European Union, the workers in Europe, the working classes, could defend their rights in a global economy. Otherwise, we would be crushed in a competition with giants like the US, China, India, Russia, Brazil. So at some point, yes, it became a project of the left, but with some ideas like the one that I remember very fondly of Jacques Delors, who was president of the European Commission and a socialist, a French socialist, he said, and I think he was right at the time, at the beginning of the 90s, when Europe was already building its single market, that we should negotiate with the US and with China a globalization with a social chart, a social compact. Inside the globalization, we should have clauses for the protection of the workers' rights.
In all of these cases, we're going to talk later about your observations about the United States, but in these transitions to a kind of a new way of relating to the world, what one seems to encounter across the board is entrenched interests that basically don't want to move to the new level, that the new challenge. Has that been a problem in Italy? I mean, you have guilds, you have traditional ways of doing things that link to the political parties and so on. How has that manifested itself in this disappointment in what was hoped for and what was not achieved?
Well, that's absolutely a problem in Italy, and it's a very hot one in this very moment. I would like to remember that just 3 months ago, Italy saw a change in its government. Silvio Berlusconi left the government, and we had a new prime minister. We've had a new prime minister, Mr. Mario Monti, who is a technocrat. And he's trying to implement structural reforms that are seen as necessary to strengthen Italian competitiveness and especially to reduce rigidities in the labor market. We have a bipolar labor market with a small part of the labor market has very, very strong rights, and it's almost impossible to fire someone. And then you have all the rest of the labor market, especially for young people. It's totally unregulated, unprotected. They have very low salaries. And so one of the structural reforms is attacking the guilds. You have a lot of professions like lawyers, even notaries in Italy, pharmacists, taxi drivers, who are like closed shop professions. You cannot enter freely. They have a monopoly on their licenses. It's very difficult to reform these sectors. While I'm talking, Prime Minister Monti in Italy is fighting a battle in the parliament, but those lobbies are very powerful. And whenever he tries to implement a reform, they're always able to vote some amendments where they will still keep their privileges.
And you've identified this problem in some of your writings of the extent to which, as part of this current crisis in Europe, what we're seeing is a decline in democracy, basically. So your prime minister now was not democratically elected. He was picked to deal with the economic problem. So on the one hand, democracy in Italy had given you Berlusconi in recent time, but now he had to leave the stage, and really it was about coming up with a technocratic program to deal with the way the bond market was perceiving Italy.
Yes, and this is not a problem only in Italy. No. Greece is another example, but that's true. I mean, make no mistake, I'm happy that Mr. Berlusconi is not our prime minister anymore. But I cannot be blind. I have to see that the way Mr. Berlusconi was ousted from government is not a healthy democratic way. He was not dismissed by a victory of the opposition in democratic elections. In fact, it was the pressure, the combined pressure by a couple of foreign government, very influential in Europe, the German government, the French government, technocratic institution like the European Commission, the European Central Bank, partially the IMF, so with some American influence too. There was a pressure in order to get rid of Berlusconi, and he was substituted by a technocrat who is basically in charge to rebuild confidence in the financial markets. He's been doing until now a good job. I mean, if you look at the spread in interest rates in yields between the Italian treasury bonds and the German treasury bonds, that spread was very wide in the second half of 2011. Now it's much lower. So building confidence is a job Mr. Mario Monti has been doing well. But because he's a technocrat, he does not address fundamental issues of social equality. and his policies are not reducing inequalities in the Italian society.
Mm-hmm. And really, it's a policy of raising taxes and cutting social welfare, in part.
Yes, which is what Germany wants. I mean, that's the recipe that the German Chancellor Angela Merkel is imposing on Italy, on Greece, on Spain, Ireland, Portugal, whoever needs some kind of support or rescue has to apply that recipe, which is, I think, very dangerous. And it's the reason why Europe is in its second recession.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little about the bond market, because it seems to be the disciplinarian here. And at a certain, you know, one can make the argument that Italy is a much stronger economy even with all of its flaws. And yet it came under attack the bond market first focused on Greece and then sort of moved across the countries of the periphery and then to Italy, which is not what one would call a peripheral country. So what is the bond market's role here? How does a person who comes out of the left perceive it?
You know, I remember, although he does, I wouldn't qualify him as a leftist. Former Treasury Secretary Larry Summers once famously said, if I will be born again, I want to be the bond market. Mm-hmm. Because of its, exactly what you said, yeah. The power that the bond markets have to discipline governments. Now, part of this is a power that we wanted to have, because I still remember when Italy had a tight regulation for transfers of capitals abroad. We had a closed capital market. It was not healthy, and in fact, it led to a lot of distortion. The allocation of resources was not optimal. I mean, we had very inefficient banks. It was kind of a parasitic system, and the Italian citizen had his savings were forced to be invested in local banks, and this led to a lot of waste. Now, Italy is, as you said, it's a strong economy. We have a very high percentage of public debt on GDP, 120%, but most of it is financed by domestic savings. Mm-hmm. And yet, as you remembered well, when in the summer of 2011 there was panic in the financial markets due to the possibility of a default by Greece, the contagion effect started, and the forecast of the market or the bet of the markets was, after Greece it will be Portugal, then Spain, then Italy, and so we were somehow forced to relinquish part of our sovereignty in order to have this firewall to protect us, a firewall built by the European Central Bank with the consentment of the German government.
I hear you saying that there's a dilemma here, in the sense that some parts of the transformation that Europe was undergoing were a good thing, the movement of capital, you know, helping to end stagnation. But on the other hand, then it enhances the power of the bond market to essentially label both Italy and Greece as basket cases, as measured by the interest rate, whether or not, you know, that's what they mean. But that's the way the fragility of Italy is perceived, as the bond market focuses first on Greece and then moves across the continent.
Yes. Here's my thinking. Markets are not a creation of nature. Markets, especially in our times, are highly regulated constructions. So let's not be naive. Governments have a lot of power if they want. to use that power. They can change the course of markets. I will take one example. Most European governments now are in favor of the so-called Tobin tax. It's called Tobin tax because the first proponent was a Nobel Prize of Economics, an American economist, James Tobin. It would be a tax on all financial transactions. And this would be a way to reduce the amount of hot money, speculative movements, like the phenomena that originated the great crisis of 2008. The problem is the U.S. and Britain don't want the Tobin tax because New York and London are the two main global financial hubs, and the banking industry is lobbying against any kind of new taxation. So it's a political issue. It's not the markets are really constructions. I mean, layers and layers of regulations that we have built in decades. So why not? Why shouldn't we add another layer of regulation and the Tobin tax? This is an issue where obviously the left in Europe is very strongly motivated against the encroached power of this lobby.
You, as I recall, you were a student of Raymond Aron, and as an international relations specialist, he must have taught you a sense of the anarchical system, and in that anarchical international system, you know, power dominates basically relative to other actors. So let's get to Germany, because one of the things, I guess, when NATO was formed, the idea was that NATO would help keep Germany in. So the institutions would be a way to constrain the danger that that Germany might pose to the continent, as it had done in two world wars. So I guess, as you said earlier, the hope of the French, once Germany united, was that the international institutions would be a vehicle for constraining German power. But what we're seeing now is that that's not the case in the economic realm. Talk a little about that, because we have this, as you just said, Merkel, and then you also, to a lesser degree, in an article you wrote recently, refer to Sarkozy. They have a they're given a married name, right? Merkel-Sarkozy?
Merkozy,
yeah. They are imposing these terms on these different countries.
Yes. Well, Merkozy is a very strange couple, and it's an unequal marriage. It's obvious that Germany has much more clout. So there's on the part of the French president, Nicolas Sarkozy, who is the other half of the couple, there's this illusion that by having a very strong alliance with Germany, he would be, or he would appear, as an equal, but he's not. And in fact, he's just accepting a diktat in terms of economic policy. So you started with the example of NATO, and it's interesting to see that nobody today perceives Germany as a potential danger on the military sphere. It's a very pacific and even pacifist country. It's a member, it's a faithful partner of NATO, participating in Afghanistan as an ally to the United States, but with a very low profile, very, very low. And the German public opinion is really, on a very vast majority, a pacifist. The problem is on the economic sphere. It's true that Germany is imposing on the rest of Europe destructive austerity, which is in its own national interest, because Germany has always had a model of development based on huge trade surpluses. They have a very competitive business system. They are, in the last decades, they've always been either the first or the second world power in terms of shares of world trade, after China and usually before the United States, or on par with the US, which is remarkable. Germany is a much smaller country than the US or obviously China. But if you always run surpluses inside a union, an economic union like the EU, the other countries are automatically running deficits. So it's really a diabolical mechanism that has enhanced the German competitiveness while keeping other countries in an inferiority situation. This comes from the obsession that Germans have of a very tight monetary policy, very tight fiscal policy. It's linked to their history, Weimar Republic, hyperinflation, but not only that. It's also that Germany is probably the last country in the world where neoclassical economics are the dominant thought. You know, neoclassical, I mean, like before Keynes, yeah. Before Keynes, yeah.
Now, ironically, as you point out in some of your writings, when you look at Germany internally, it's a pretty progressive place, environmentally conscious, labor at the table of the companies and participating in directorship of the companies and on pacifistic. There's no, you know, no intention to go the route of war. So there's a real irony here, yeah. in the sense that they're doing well. The German internal situation is a very good one, but their ideas about how their partners should behave and copy their fiscal restraint has very dire consequences for places like Greece and the other pigs.
Yeah, yeah. I would almost say, just as a joke, because I remember my Marxist origins or communist origins, that Germany has built socialism in a single country, which was, you know, the yeah. famous theory, a controversial theory in the Soviet Union at some point. Yes, when we say we use the expression the European social model, the best example is Germany, and it's a very strong, thriving, and competitive model. They have the highest salaries in the world for workers, for factory workers. They have the most powerful unions. They have the tightest environmental regulations in the world, and yet they thrive in a global economy and. Their export to China has increased dramatically in the last decade. So it's somehow a vindication of socialism or social democracy, because the German model is very much the result of the social democratic tradition, together with the Christian democratic tradition. So both have merged into creating this this model. But at the same time, Germany is now imposing on its neighbors, on its European partners, austerity policies that are dismantling, destroying welfare states in the neighboring country. What is happening in Greece, but also on a smaller scale in Italy or in Spain, is rather a shift towards a more free market U.S.-style economy.
And what that means concretely for Greece and the other peripheral countries is there is imposed austerity. Budgets by the government have to be cut. People have to be laid off. Social welfare programs are cut. To the extent that people are hurting across the board, and it's leading to riots and all sorts of disorder, all in the name of making them, I guess, in quotes, fiscally responsible, so one day they can be like Germany. There's a weird disconnect here because there's no evidence that, in fact, there's evidence the other way, that these programs don't lead to their becoming more like Germany. It leads to desperation and recession, if not depression.
Yes. And, you know, Germany has imposed what is being called now a new fiscal compact in Europe, with extremely tight rules of fiscal discipline. One example is that under the new treaty, it will be ratified by national parliament as a new treaty, countries will not be allowed to run a public deficit superior to 0.5% of GDP. That's even tighter than the previous Maastricht Treaty, which had the upper limit 3% deficit to GDP. And I would just like to remind that while we are talking, the U.S. deficit to GDP ratio is 8.5%. So this is the kind of discipline that European countries are undergoing because Germany wants it to be. The effect on Greece is dramatic. You described some of the consequences. I would add that Greece has now had 3 years in a row of decrease of its GDP. The loss of national income is 15%, and they are entering the fourth year in a row of recession. In a country like Spain, you have an unemployment rate of 23% of the workforce, almost 50% among youth. So obviously there are riots. And in this situation where you would need a stimulus package, in fact, governments have to cut again and again, reduce healthcare, reduce unemployment benefits, reduce salaries and wages in the public sector. It is counterintuitive. And now the German theory is that by reducing the deficit and the public debt, they will rebuild confidence and then investments will start again. But how is this possible? If you have the GDP decreasing, the ratio of the debt will increase. It's pure arithmetic. And if you don't have purchasing power in your population, if consumptions are down, why should companies invest? Why should business investment restart when the population doesn't have purchasing power? So it's like 1937, you know, when in the middle of the Great Depression, at some point, President Roosevelt here in the United States thought that the Depression was over and it was time to attain fiscal balance. It was a dramatic mistake, a tragic mistake.
Is this a legacy of bad ideas, basically, or an unwillingness to accept Keynesianism? Paul Krugman has, you know, run the data, and he says, well, look, these places, deficits weren't their problem. The cost of social welfare programs were not the problem of these countries we're talking about. It was really balance of payments, which is what you were talking about and described. So it's almost as if Germany can't see the actual cause of the problem because of the ideas they have about what works.
Yes, that is certainly part of the problem. A legacy of bad ideas is a perfect definition of the German problem. At the same time, you have, because we can't just put the whole blame on Germans. So let's try to put ourselves in the place of the Germans and see how they perceive the situation at the periphery of the Eurozone. Well, German citizens have read for years, since the start of the crisis in 2008, that tax fraud is rampant in Mediterranean Europe. In Italy, over more than 15% of GDP is the amount of tax evasion. In Greece, it's even higher than that. Several Greek governments manipulated the data on the deficit. They were false data. False information was fed to the European Commission. You have, while I'm talking, you have Greek politicians, well-known Greek politicians, who are transferring their money into Swiss accounts because they fear that Greece will go out of the euro. So, for German citizens with their rule-obeying tradition, they're very disciplined society. They see these Mediterranean countries as unruly, with a lot of parasitic categories, incompetent ruling classes, and they don't see why they should pay. Why they don't understand why a blue collar worker in Germany, who had to tighten his own belt at times, should bail out a rich tax evader in Greece.
Or an early retiree.
Or an early retiree, because you have these the legendary civil servants who could retire at when they were 55.
Let's talk now about the United States. You're here covering this country for your newspaper and heading the bureau. What do you make of the Obama presidency and its efforts to deal both with the 2008 economic collapse, the 2008 economic collapse, and actually the effort to move to a new global economy, to prepare America to be more competitive?
Well, first of all, as a European, I have to say that President Obama still enjoys a very high popularity in Europe. He would be reelected immediately in Europe if he ran as president for Europe. And even the left, European left, although it has been slightly disappointed by the Obama policies, they still probably see in Barack Obama the only progressive leader in the world that can make them dream, that is charismatic, that is a symbol of something new. We don't have leaders of the left in power almost nowhere in Europe now. And we don't see progressive leaders in emerging countries, definitely not in China, not in Russia either. And Europeans also see that although he had to confront and sometimes fight Congress, where after the midterm elections of 2010, part of the Congress had a Republican majority, Obama was able to implement a stimulus package with remarkable results. And the U.S. economy is recovering, whereas the Eurozone is headed back into a recession. So overall, the judgment on this Obama administration is positive in Europe and especially among progressives.
And what do you make of the Republican Party and its effort to present an alternative that seems to come from the past and in certain aspects from the medieval past?
Well, yes, as a European reporter covering the Republican primaries, sometimes I feel a total disconnect. I mean, no conservative party in Europe, I'm thinking of the Christian Democrats in Germany, the conservatives in Britain, Sarkozy in France, no conservative party would ever dare follow the evolution of the American Republican Party, this polarization, this radicalization of its language, be it on social values, economic policies. It's for a European, it's perceived as an extreme party, very, very radical party of the extreme right. And also what strikes me when I cover the Republican primaries is hearing Mitt Romney or Rick Santorum, especially Mitt Romney, in fact, depicting Europe as the continent of socialism. It's almost like we have become the new empire of evil. There's mm-hmm. no more. The Soviet Union does not exist anymore. So now it's us.
Mm-hmm. But you can be saved, whereas the Soviet Union had to be eliminated. But what is the difference here? Is it European parties that make the electorate more mature? Is it a richer history and one not distorted by open spaces and freedom and so on? What is your take on because it's not just the quality of the candidates has declined, say in the Republican Party. They're tapping something in American political culture that lets them get away with what they're doing.
Yeah. Well, I first of all, I don't want to give the impression that I idealize our own political systems back in Europe. We have lots of problems, and we are usually, on average, not very happy about our own leaders and our own governments. But I can see a divergence in the political dynamics, because in Europe we still have the political game is functioning so that you have moderates ruling the game. I mean, in the end, whether in Germany it's the Christian Democrats, that is the conservatives in power, or the social democrats in power, the policies won't be very, very different. They will cater to the center. So there will be a more leftist approach in the social democrats, a more conservative approach in the Christian Democrats, but they don't want to destroy the welfare state. Nobody wants to destroy the welfare state in Europe. Whereas in the US, you've had this polarization, and especially on the right side, there has been the language that US Republicans are using now would make them probably incomprehensible even to Ronald Reagan. They shifted so far to the right that even Ronald Reagan now would sound like a moderate in comparison. It's something to do with probably with the role of religion in U.S. Politics, but also with a representation, almost a sacred representation of the virtues of the free markets. And again, ideologies can play a destructive role. I mean, how can't you see how the free markets were at the heart of the last financial crisis. Unregulated markets produced the crisis of 2008. How can you possibly want even more deregulation in the financial markets, in Wall Street? And yet, this is ideology can be totally disconnected from reality.
Do you think that ideas and ideologies and their importance for the future, do you think that the left worldwide is offering a package of ideas to help us define the future?
Not enough. In fact, what I perceive is a tremendous absence of the left. And I mentioned the fact that no major European country now has a government of the left. Whereas I think that this crisis demands that kind of response. I mean, I can't see a reasonable exit from this economic crisis without a return to a redistribution, a strong action against social inequalities. This is really a crisis that bears a lot of comparisons and analogies, similarities with the 20s, before 29 and the Great Depression, where you had these extreme inequalities. So we have to reduce inequality. And this is typically the job of the left. I think that we are now in a transition time with the decline of the West, the emergence of new powers, so that we cannot imagine a new model of economic development that would not be shared by China, India, Brazil. And this, again, I think, is a point in favor of the left, because the left in its history always had a universal vision. The left was born with the idea that we had universal values and we had to find new solutions together, not just on a national basis. Whereas the conservatives can limit their own message, their own strategy, their own scope inside the borders of a national state country.
And what about leadership? What sort of leadership are we going to need to take whatever ideas emerge and move them to a future which is progressive? The criticism of President Obama, despite how popular he may be in Europe, is that he's been too weak, that he's given in too much, especially when it comes to letting the narrative become one of deficits, you know, as opposed to other aspects, you know, of the agenda. So he's put markers down for environmentalism, for healthcare reform, and so on. But he's often appeared to be half-hearted in his effort, or not successful in sort of overcoming the entrenched interests that want to prevent that from happening.
Yes. Well, my view, the main criticism that one should address to President Obama from the left should regard the issue of money and politics. I mean, I was very disappointed when President Obama decided to open to the super PACs in order to counterbalance the Republican super PAC. I mean, I think this goes to the heart of the problem. Why President Obama was not able to deliver? Because lobbies, entrenched powers, had this enormous clout in the American political system. And obviously, this problem even increased after the Supreme Court sentence of 2010. So I think this is really the issue. If this is an issue of democracy, we desperately need to go back to a system where there is one citizen, one vote, and not one corporation, 1 billion votes. But I'm a bit skeptical if we talk only about leadership is I come from a tradition of the left where we had a disease that was called the personality cult. At some point, be it Stalin or Mao, we transformed our leaders into saints or semi-gods. We should go back to the origins of the left, where it's the power is bottom up. And so we should not just elect an Obama and then hope that he will deliver. We have to build grassroots movements. And this is what can really change the balance of power in our societies.
Well, on that note, Federico, I want to thank you for coming back on our program and giving us this very fascinating discussion. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you very much for joining us for this conversation with history.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.